Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 67 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. So who are you and what do you do?
I am Jorge Roeder, and I play the bass. I play the double bass.
Playing it for a long time.
A long time indeed. I was trying to figure out when is that I started on electric bass. I picked it up when I was 14, so that's 24 years ago. No, 26 years ago, sorry. And the upright when I was 18, so that was 22 years ago.
So talk a bit about the transition. I mean, 14 to 18. Most people that I know stick to the electric bass. The stand-up, the double bass is not an easy instrument to gig and travel around with. What made you do that transition?
Well, there is a third part of this equation that I was into at the time, which is the cello. I started playing cello when I was 14 as well, as I started playing electric. I used to play guitar when I was younger. And at age 14, there were two branches that came out in my musical experience. One was going into a rock band that needed a bass player. I mean, fellow 14-year-old students that just wanted to get together and play. And also, my school started a classical music program, the first one in the country. And for whatever reason, I ended up in the cello. I think I said to myself, it's the instrument that looks most like a guitar. And I didn't think of pursuing the double bass at that time. But the mixture of the electric and the cello slowly started piquing my interest for the upright. I was in school orchestra a few years after that, you know, I was maybe 16, playing the cello part. And I was seeing that the upright basses were playing a similar part, but lower. And it just sounded better to me. So between playing electric bass and playing the cello and thinking that the upright bass was better, I think in the end, at 18, I was like, this is got to be my thing, the upright bass.
It's such an interesting story that actually resonates really personally with me, because the way I got introduced to the bass, strangely enough, was my brother's friend, who was about 6 years older than me, and I was also probably 13, 14, who had taken the frets out of his electric bass, which was a sort of very non-Fender type ripoff bass, and not only did he do that because he was clearly, you know, had been exposed to Jaco Pastorius, but he was a cellist. And I started playing bass because of a cellist. And it's interesting to have conversations about this instrument, because there does seem to be that sort of, it's a historical legacy, of course, to get to where we are today. But it's funny how the tones of this instrument really do resonate, and it's a bit of a pun or cliche to say that, probably both. but it's interesting, and I'm also interested that it happens around that age very frequently, that sort of 14 to 16-year-old thing too. Now, a lot of us, it's because there's already a guitar player and a drummer, so you get stuck with it.
I that's exactly what happened to me. And I have to say, funny you mentioned now, we're going to keep ping-ponging this, but I ripped the frets off my acoustic guitar. I mean, I created my first bass out of an acoustic guitar, and I just put bass strings over, you know, the four middle holes of this acoustic guitar, a classical kind of nylon string, you know, where they just have the holes. They don't have the little caps that they put in the strings of you know, like Martin guitars. And I remember trying to jam that like thick string through that little hole. And, you know, just there was this had like just bits of string hanging from the end of it. And I realized that it was completely out of tune. So I ripped the frets. This is I can claim that I did that before I heard who Jaco was. Then I did that again to my electric bass because of Jaco. But the first bass I had, I made out of an old guitar and ripped the frets off. So I was definitely hearing something. I wanted to hear something in particular, you know.
So let's go a bit further back before we move the conversation a bit forward. You started off originally playing guitar. You were born in Peru?
Correct. I was born in Lima, Peru. And when I was 8 years old, my mom bought a guitar and wanted me and my two older sisters to learn, to take lessons. And there was a guy in the neighborhood that played guitar pretty well, a flamenco, if I remember correctly. And so he started teaching us from scratch. I remember the first, not the first, but the second lesson. I mean, I was barely holding the instrument at age eight. And the teacher said, okay, here are four notes. So he showed me these four notes. And at one point he's like, okay, now improvise. And I completely I didn't even know, you know, like he explained to me what improvising was, just like make it up. And I couldn't, you know, like there's a part of my brain that was, it's impossible. I cannot make something up, you know. In a way that was a hang up for a while, you know, much later in life, I became an improviser, but that kept hanging on me. Like, will I ever, you know, overcome the fear of that first request to improvise?
It's funny how it is true, though, that when you think about music or art or any creative endeavor, that it's very hard to improvise until you have a level of comfort with the tool. I mean, it is an interesting thing where you would think it's the opposite. Just pick it up and play around with it.
Yeah, play around with it.
It's such an interesting thought that had never occurred to me until you said that it is true that in order to do something freely, most people need to have a certain level of comfort with the rules.
Certainly. And the more one master their instrument, you know, the more tools one has to become freer with it.
What was happening when you were growing up in Lima, Peru, in terms of music and influence? Was it mostly family pressure? Was it a peer pressure? What were you exploring? What was happening? Because it's such a unique part of the world, too.
Certainly. And, you know, we have a rich musical tradition that some of it is European influence, but also there's an African influence. There's Afro-Peruvian music that seeped into the culture. Of course, you know, like as it has been the case in a lot of places, it happened with a lot of resistance at first and a lot of racism involved. But I feel it's become an intrinsic part of the culture. So what we call Peruvian music or Creole music, música criolla, is absolutely mixed. You know, there and bands will have, you know, they would probably be the most diverse groups of people you'd see, much less segregated than the country is, in fact.
But there was other things happening because you're not isolated. So you're exposed to stuff that's happening in popular music and rock and roll. How was that impacting you? Like, what were you listening to at the time? What were the bands that you were sort of keying into beyond the local traditional scene?
Certainly. I think the first band that I was into was a Mexican band by the name of Maná. And I was just obsessed with the way they were able to play. They had this kind of ska, like a ska influence. And the drummer, I think he really wanted to be like the drummer from The Police, whose name I'm blanking right now.
I want to say Stuart Copeland, but Stuart I'm worried Copeland. That that's the
you're,
guitar no, player.
Okay. I think you're correct.
Okay.
The drummer, he became very, very famous, at least in the Latin American rock scene. But I remember seeing him. It's the first live show I saw. I think I was maybe 12 or 13. But I also had seen many of their music videos. And, you know, this is the moment where MTV became huge, you know, the early 90s. I remember watching MTV, like I got like a... how do you call it, like a, I guess an illegal cable connection. And so I was able to watch MTV. And I remember when a song came on that I liked, I would tape it on my VHS. And so I would create files of, you know, EP VHS tapes that would hold, I don't know, I think 6 hours worth of music.
And I'm going to take a shot in the dark here, Jorge, and say yeah. We're talking about the 80s. Am I right?
This is, well, I was in the early 90s is when, for me, that okay. it really... MTV became popular in Peru, at least. Yes, MTV started on the 80s. You're correct. But for me, like MTV in Peru became very popular because I don't want to say something incorrect here, but I feel cable came on right around that time, like late 80s, early 90s. Sure. So anyway. I was watching MTV. I was taping all these songs. So like, anything that I liked, I would tape. And if I wouldn't, you know, a song would start and I liked it, and I would listen again. Like I would stay on MTV until it came on again, and I would tape it. And so I created a whole log of songs that I like. So I was listening to, you know, in this early mid 90s, I was listening to Pearl Jam, I was listening to Nirvana, Stone Temple Pilots, all these bands. And as I was starting to play bass at age, well, first on guitar, I started to basically playing along and transcribing and trying to figure out what the songs were and what the chords were. And I, you know, kind of got my ear training going. And later when I started picking up the bass, I focused completely on what the bass line is. So I would listen to a piece of music and I would just isolate the bass in my head. Like, what is the bass doing? And that I would try to figure out. And if the bass line was cool, I would try to play it, play along with it and, you know, learn it as exactly as possible. So that was part of my kind of informal training, playing along with recordings, basically.
And at what point were you sort of deciding the more professional path? Like, how old were you? Because I know you did study the bass. I know you studied even the cello in Russia, I think.
That's correct.
Explain the sort of educational path you took with music.
Well, the way I remember, I guess it was a little staggered, or there were several paths. So in my school, as I mentioned, there was a classical music program. That program allowed me to travel to Russia to study cello. I wasn't very good. I just had a lot of, you know, I really wanted to do it. And there was an opportunity for a group of us in the school to go. It was an expensive trip. My parents had to take out a loan, but we did it. We thought it was a really good opportunity, and so we did it. So I was going into this classical path that I was pursuing. I wasn't that into it, but I after learning cello for a bit, I realized that I could, you know, play it in an okay way, and I somewhat liked it. But at that time, I feel like I wanted to play rock more. And so I was leaning more towards the bass. I was, you know, watching videos. I had this cassette tape VHS tape of an instructional video that my cousin gave me from Stuart Hamm. And so he was doing this tapping stuff, and I was like, you know, I gotta learn this stuff. It sounds like he was playing like a Beethoven piano piece on the bass, and I was like, well, I gotta learn this now. You know, it's a mixture of classical but on the electric bass, so it was a novel thing to me. On that same VHS tape, there was an instructional video by Jeff Berlin, who was more of a jazz fusion bass player, and he was playing things that I could not understand. I think this is the first instance where I heard jazz language and I could not understand it for the life of me. I was attracted to the technicality of it and how it was amazing for me that people could play more notes, you know, with that were not in the same scale, you know, like all the notes that I knew were on the, you know, pentatonic blues scale. How do you get out of that scale and play more notes and still make sense? You know, I remember thinking that. And so I remember in this instructional video, there's a little clip of him, of Jeff Berlin playing a duet with Jaco at like Musicians Institute or something like that.
Yeah.
And I barely knew who Jaco was at this particular point, but I remember thinking, wow, like this guy is pretty insane.
I don't need to play anymore.
Yeah. You know, like, definitely my interest in jazz was peaked in the back of my head, but at the time I was like more like technique and let's figure out how to play like fast and accurate and strong, you know. And you know, as I told you, like later I became more interested in the upright, and I think several things converged there. My interest in classical music, I got the ability to, because of my bass, double bass teacher, I was able to enter as a kind of a bit of a practice role to a professional symphony orchestra, and practice there next to him to really work on symphonic works was absolutely amazing. And then I would finish that gig and go to like some dive bar and play like heavy metal with my rock band on the fretless five string, you know. So I was doing these two things pretty regularly at that age. And so I think jazz came on because of the upright. I was exposed to it, but it was for me just a means, you know, a means to just get better. But I wasn't really interested in playing jazz up until I started playing upright. And I got a chance of getting into a student jazz orchestra after I left school, age 19. And my path was completely decided then. Like, I want to play jazz. I want to be a jazz double bass player.
And where did the New England Conservatory come in?
Well, the people with whom I was playing at this student jazz ensemble, the band director had a connection with the now defunct IAJE, International Association for Jazz Education. They used to host, I think maybe potentially they're called the JEN now, Jazz Education Network. But anyway, that company or that association stopped. But they used to hold conventions every January. You know, it was like associated with APAP, with all this like all these New York festivals, and they would hold their association convention in New York. I think every other year they would do it in Long Beach. They would do it in Toronto or Montreal. They would do it in several cities. And the convention was, I think, lasted about, 3 days to a week or something. And there were all kinds of events, and it happened in the Hilton and the Sheraton of Manhattan. Anyway, I got the chance of going there and perform with this student big band in this convention. And made connections with people. I was able to return the following year, this time to Long Beach, and I played with a smaller ensemble. And the chair of NEC Jazz Studies was at the event and saw me playing, and we struck up conversation, and he asked me if I was interested in studying at NEC, and I was like, Yes, I am. But yeah, I had a chance to live in Boston because my sister had been living there for the last, I believe, 4 or 5 years. So I had a place to stay. So I thought this is probably my chance of going.
Was Lima, Peru a place for you to leave? Like, did you think it'd be great if I could do it here? Or were you one of those people, I'm leaving here. If I want to pursue this type of music, it's really going to happen for me in a New York, in a Boston, in a Chicago. What were you just emotionally, where were you?
Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking of a particular city, but when I was about 20 or 21 and I was going to these conventions and I saw like the things that I saw, the music, I noticed that there was a level of performance and of artistry was just incomparable. And I wanted to be surrounded by it. And when I went back to Lima, I was playing with musicians there, with amazing musicians. And one percussion player who was very dear to me, one of the most amazing percussionists in Peru, his name is Gigio Parodi. He once, after we played a show, he came up to me, grabbed my arm and told me, hey man, if you want to do what you are doing better, you have to leave. You can't stay here. And I think you can do really well if you leave, so you should do it. And I thought that was really good advice. Even though I already had leaving in my crosshairs, that was a really important reassurance. It would have been close to impossible to do what I'm doing had I stayed in Peru, make a living playing the music that I want to play. There would have had to be much more compromise of one sort or the other.
I was going to ask you if you still believe that to be true.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Still to this day. I still talk to friends, you know. I mean, it has progressed, definitely. Things have gotten better, but it's still really hard to make a living. You have to supplement it with teaching, which I don't have to do right now. I can live off performing, which is my dream.
Yeah. So where do you call home officially now? Is it New York?
Yes. That's Brooklyn, great. New York is where I call home.
Yeah, I guess now is an interest. Like, we're recording this during the pandemic, obviously. And one of the things that really caught my attention in following you is that you've been very active in live, in playing online. I was wondering what made you decide and how you feel about this sort of virtual gigging world we now live in, or just the fact that you... I mean, for me, it's nice to just see you and watch you play. And it's comforting when I'm sitting here. It makes me a little less lonely, even though we're very far apart.
Right.
How do you feel about it?
I like it a lot. It doesn't compare to being in a room with people that are listening to you. It's the next best, and it's what we have right now. So I'm happy to do it. And so far, the couple of chances that I've had to play online have been very fulfilling and very. They give me this adrenaline rush that I feel when I play live, which ultimately I think is the feeling I want to feel when I'm playing. So that it has been a very nice substitute.
Yeah, it's been a challenging time for people. Mm-hmm. You could probably hear it, even as I ask it, my voice cracks because mm-hmm. I'm a professional speaker and all mm-hmm. of my gigs have been pretty much canceled too.
Right.
Where do you put your creative energy? How have you been channeling it? And by the way, it's completely fine to say, I'm sitting up curled in a corner and I don't know what to do, because I think that's honestly, I think it's a very fair reaction too for people.
For sure. Well, right now I've been focusing on getting better, and that's what's giving me energy. You know, for the first time in my life, I'm not moving. You know, this is truly the first time since I became a professional musician where I'm at the same place with both my instruments. Now I have a lot of domestic tasks to do. I'm in charge of homeschooling my child, and you know, like my wife is still working from home, so she has a very tight schedule of work, and so I don't get a lot of time to practice. But now I feel like a razor sharp focus on what I want to do and how I want to practice, which is great. Sometimes I do the same thing over and over again, and it just feels fulfilling. I feel like I'm, you know, I should say this is that's kind of a side note, but I had an injury a couple months ago, right before the pandemic struck. Had a herniated disc in my cervical vertebrae in my spine, and I couldn't play. I basically lost use of my right arm. It's not that I couldn't move it, but it was tingling and hurting, and it just was feeling pretty bad. I had to, as a matter of fact, cancel an important recording because of it, and I was devastated. And so, you know, luckily it wasn't, you know, it was a treatable situation, and I was able to treat it and do physical therapy. And as the country started closing up, I had recovered enough that I didn't have to go, you know, take tests or have shots or get, you know, go to physical therapy. I was able to recover by myself. And so I've been taking this time, in a way, has been a blessing, because I'm relearning to play with a better technique, a technique that doesn't demand this that much of me, that I will have to, you know, fall again into this herniated disc situation. I'm basically planning a new scheme of performing on my instrument that does not require for me to get as strained as I have been in the past. So it's been pretty amazing for me to in my practice routine to focus on that, on making sure that I won't strain my neck, basically.
It's very strange how in this pandemic, similar, we have had a situation as well where it's given me certain time back to readjust something else.
Mm.
And that for some people, as crazy and tragic as this is, there's also this weird sort of ray of light, which is like, as you're recovering, and I'm glad to hear that it's worked out and you're healthy. It's obviously the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's strange that like, somebody handed you this strange gift too, of having the time to really recuperate and use this sort of physiotherapy for playing as a moment that's pretty lucky too.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, this has been, as you say, has been so difficult on so many people, and myself included. This is not like all rosy, but on the performance aspect, you know, like I was out of commission for the first time in my life, like 3 weeks before the pandemic struck. So what a weird time.
Yeah. What do you think was your first big break in the business outside of school? What do you think was your first big break?
It's hard to gauge because one thing leads to another, as they say. I would say when I went into sub for Scott Colley in Gary Burton's band was a pretty important break for me. And I'm saying one thing leads to the other, because that wouldn't have been possible without Julian Lash, who recommended me for that gig to sub for Scott Colley. And so meeting Julian was truly my big break.
Yeah. And that relationship is, it's one for the ages. Can you talk a little bit about how you met Julian, the work, you know, how you feel about the legacy of work you're building together?
Mm. Well, I met Julian back in 2004, I'd like to say, pretty early on. Yeah, I think so. 2004, 2005. I was out in California for visiting some family, and a friend was teaching at the Stanford Jazz Workshop, and I was interested in going to Stanford Jazz Workshop just for a moment to see if I could catch a glimpse and hopefully take a lesson with Rufus Reed, with whom I was absolutely obsessed at the time. Still am, to be honest. But my friend got me in touch with Rufus, and Rufus was gracious enough to tell me, yeah, I have a free moment here this day, this time, come in. And so I drove, luckily I was maybe 25 minutes away by car from Stanford University. So I drove to Stanford and I took a lesson with Rufus. And I have to mention this because I think it's relevant. Rufus didn't charge me for the lesson. I was ready to pay him for it. And he's like, don't worry, man, just pay it forward, you know, which was extremely touching for me. And I think that's, I think if one is able to do that, I think one should just kind of spread the love. But in this same day, my friend said, hey, there's this guitar player that I've been playing with that is incredible and you need to play with him. I've set up a session. Like, if you can stay right after the lesson, just stay for a little longer and we'll just play a session. And so we got into some sort of like broom closet at Stanford University with Julian, my friend Ben, who played the saxophone, and Peter Bernstein. Now, I was like, well, we're playing with Peter Bernstein. It's amazing. What are you talking about, this guitar player? I'm here for Peter Bernstein, clearly. And then we started playing, the four of us, and it was incredible. I mean, Julian was shining. And I remember I threw in, because there was no drums, I was kind of like being the rhythmic, throwing the rhythmic ball, curveballs. And I started playing in an Afro-Peruvian groove, which a lot of times it throws people off. Julian was absolutely unfazed, and he just like, started playing as if he knew the groove exactly, you know, like that kind of natural ability to play music that's always been inspiring to me. So that's how we met. Now we, you know, we really liked each other's playing, but we didn't really do anything with that at the time. It was not until after 2.5 or 3 years later that I moved to New York and he moved to Boston, that through a mutual friend, an amazing drummer, Richie Barshay, that Julian was looking for a bass player and would, if I wanted to come to Boston to just rehearse with this band. So I went in and rehearsed with this band. It was a quintet with saxophone, piano, drums, guitar, and bass. And we did one show at Ryle's Club in Cambridge. And it was amazing. You know, it was, first of all, like, yeah, I lived in Boston for many years, and Ryle's Jazz Club, you know, it was a club where I got to play several times. I had never seen it packed in my life. And it was just bustling completely. That night was, I felt it was quite a success. Julian, I think, had a harder time. It was just, I think it was his first gig as a leader. But the connection was really established at this point. And even though that band ceased to exist after that show, he crafted a different band from that. And that became his working group for the next 5 years, I'd like to say. We established a really amazing relationship. We've played in so many formats, trio, quartet, quintet, duo. We've had a few duo tours. And I think ultimately our philosophy, or, you know, what we kind of teach each other, is all about like communication, humility, just being in the present, it's really important for us not to get caught on like what we want to present or what we want to do or what we practice. It's more like really being in the moment, playing with each other, listening to each other, and being there for each other.
So when you think about just the genre of jazz and even modern jazz, I live in Montreal, actually, and mm-hmm. you know, one of the things when I talk to people about what's really impacted me the most, I have to say, because they canceled it early on, but it was the Montreal International Jazz Festival. You know, when they canceled that, it was a real sort of like, well, this must be really serious. It was like that type of thing. And again, as I think through what a festival like that means to people who live and breathe jazz music, to people who play in the clubs, to the fact that jazz is, to me, somewhat always on some strange like lifeline type of thing. It's like always on the. How do you think about it? Do you worry about it? Do you think that we're going to see so much great music come out of this because of quarantine and isolation? I mean, these clubs may not be able to reopen, type of thing. Are you having these conversations? Are you thinking about them? Or are you just head down, recovery, practice, play, do your thing?
No, I mean, I'm definitely discussing with friends, people that I encounter. I am of two minds with this topic. First, in the more like bigger picture, broad, you know, if we look at like the 21st century and how this happened earlier, the 21st century, it would be a glitch. You know, art, I think, is going to survive it. This is not going to be a big issue in the big scheme of things. So in that sense, you know, in a really zoomed out spot, I would feel like this is fine and it's going to encourage new ways of creating art anyway. On the other hand, a more urgent zoomed in thing, like, you know, I see like, you know, venues gasping for air and I want to help them and I want to, you know, they shouldn't go under, you know, like, I feel like, oh, someone should support, like we should fundraise for this. You know, like I've played several fundraisers online one straight fundraiser for the radio station WBGO here in Newark. The fact that a radio station needs to fundraise this heavily just for the pandemic is, you know, it's a sign of the dire state of our medium. But I'm struggling with these two ideas, the idea that, like, the urgency of needing to keep this afloat, not, you know, as you say, like the Montreal Jazz Festival being canceled is almost an impossible thought. At the same time, I feel, you know, with a little bit of luck, it'll come back the next year, you know, and it'll be okay. You know, there'll be adjustment. Some of us will, if not all of us, are going to come out changed of this, you know.
It's so true that one of the things I keep talking about is this ability that we need as creative people to hold these two very different concepts in our minds at the same time. And we're not good at it. I think creative people are better at it, but we're not good at it. This ability to say like, oh, it's going to come back, it's going to be great, to the other being like, I saw a picture just the other day of a theater in Germany where they basically have like one seat and then the two next to it on either side removed. And you could see in the ground the actual sort of outline of where the seat was. Then it's like two seats together, then two removed. And then like it was so supremely depressing. I heard you sigh there. It's so supremely depressing to think like, who's going to want to sit in a theater and watch a show like that? And then that could be a reality. And the other reality I'm hoping for is that it's not that, right? And where Jorge stayed home long enough to write this seminal album that makes everybody love modern jazz or jazz more. Like there's all these weird equations that we really have to hold into our heads at the same time. It's not easy.
Yeah. It's it it I have a hard time dealing with that duality, as I'm telling you, because this is the first time I've expressed the two mind thing, you know. And as I say it, I'm like, I'm feeling chills myself. Like, how could I say this?
You know? Right, it's hard. Yeah,
yeah,
it's hard. When you need to escape, who are some of the players that you look to? And I'm not looking for you to call any one or two names, but I'm just curious, as a bass player, when you're thinking about the bass and you need a bit of separation between you and the art, who are some of the names that come to your mind?
I mean, when I just want to listen, one of the bass players that I just enjoy listen to the most, and I think this is why he's such a big influence, is Charlie Hayden. Mm. It's like almost like he can do no wrong.
Yeah.
Every recording I hear, every new thing I hear, it's just, you know, I could say like that clear was a mistake, but it doesn't matter. You know, that's for me such a lesson. You know, I want to play in a way where like I played that and that was a mistake, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah. What an amazing, like, wow, like, what an amazing philosophical and inspirational thought, actually, because we do think of perfection in a different way, but it's true that when we listen to a lot, I think Charlie Hayden is a great example of that, by the way. You could, if you are ever bored, just mm-hmm. going and onto your Apple Music or Spotify, and just typing in Charlie Hayden takes you down rabbit hole. I mean, it does not end. And
no.
It's true that, like, when we think of jazz or just music in general, that it is often those sort of things that shouldn't be that are that make us really strive for excellence, mm-hmm. isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit for everyone, I think, in jazz. And and for me, you know, just talking about Charlie makes me smile. You know, I'm already, like, telling you this with a grin. I just found out that that the album, the Pat Metheny album 8081, was recorded 40 years ago. That was recorded, it was my 40th birthday 2 days ago, so it that they started tracking on May 26th, which was the day I was born. And hey, I was just like, that hey, added a huge new meaning.
I'm May 24.
Wow.
So there you go.
There you go.
So yeah, that I haven't, you know, it's funny, I wrote down the album because, again, what's greater than hopping onto Apple Music and then going down to Pat Metheny 8081 moment?
Oh,
there's nothing wrong with that, right? There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I want to end on going back to this idea of improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
When you are working, I mean, you have a new solo album, El Suelo
mm-hmm.
Mio.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how you think about charting, writing versus improv versus deep improv? And what I mean by deep improv is not, well, I'm going to do some stuff around this chord here, but I'm actually going to have no idea what these other instruments are doing, and we're going to see what language we create. Because that's a whole other level of improv, to me at least.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I conceptualize this album was in so many different levels of that push and pull between improvisation and composition. There's definitely one piece I can think in the record that where nothing, there's not one note that is improvised, but then there's one piece in the album where there's not one note that's composed. So for me, in performance, in anything that I like to present, I'd like to strike the best balance between composition and improvisation that I can. And I strive to do that with the groups that I'm a sideman of, which is, you know, like, luckily I've been given a lot of leeway in that regard by the band leaders I work with. But I think they are also of the same mind, and they know that ideal is one that's conducive to you know, meaningful show, something that will actually bring joy to people. I've been finding in the last few years that the shows that I play have a if we approach them in the right way, they can have like a transformative effect on audiences and on ourselves. So we try to keep at this like kind of high vibrating level most of the time, where we go from absolutely composed stuff to absolutely improvised. And one at any given moment can just turn left and say like, nope, the song's over. We're going to just go here. It's done not in a random way, but in a way that, you know, that it's not a, I feel like it's done in a tasteful way, you know, not in a way that is completely, random. So approaching the concept of this album, it has a lot of composed things, composed structure, which is really important to me. I feel like proportion in a piece of sections is the hardest thing for me today to master. And Julian has become really good at it. And he has been watching John Sorn's ability to master proportion. And that's definitely my go-to when I think about proportion in form for music. So say there's a piece in my album that has a written part at the beginning and a written part at the end. And the middle, no idea. You know, or in the middle, there's one indication. There's just keep a low D going. That's it. The rest you can make up, you know. So there are, I feel like there are so many layers of balance between improvisation and composition that one can use. And I feel like when they are all used in a set of music or in a record, in a good proportion, I feel like creates a really amazing effect.
Yeah, and you hear it in the music. It's unbelievable. I hope I didn't butcher the name of it.
Oh, you did great.
Mio. Okay,
yeah.
Great. Jorge, thank you so much for your time and your music and your sort of passion for keeping jazz alive, which I think is such a needed skill, especially when you are only 40 years old. It even encourages me more, and I'm not that much older than you, so it's a great sign. And my real hope is that within a short period of time, I can walk not far from where I live and walk into an event at the Mountain Trail Jazz Festival and hopefully shake your hand. That would be great.
that will be great. Thank you so much, Mitch.
Let people know where they can connect to you, connect to the music. Let them know.
Sure. I'm on Jorge Roeder. .bandcamp.com. If you want to connect directly to the music, you can do that there. I'm fairly active on Instagram. You can find me there as well, Jorge Roeder. It's spelled J-O-R-G-E-R-O-E-D-E-R.
That's great, Jorge. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.